You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hey there, I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. The Lasker Awards are one of the most respected science prizes in the world. They honor visionary scientists whose research and perseverance have led to advances that will prolong life and prevent disease. Michael Sheets, professor of biology at Columbia University, James Spudich, professor of cellular and molecular pharmacology at Stanford University School of Medicine, and Ronald Vail, professor of cellular and molecular pharmacology and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the University of California, San Francisco, just received the Lasker Award for Basic Medical Research for their discovery of machine-like cytoskeletal proteins. I'm very pleased to have all three of you professors with me this afternoon. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
You actually didn't get the award yet. The ceremony is tomorrow.
Yes.
At the Pierre, and it comes with some money, right?
A little bit.
A little bit? You're not counting it yet until you get it in your hand?
Yeah.
All right, I don't blame you. I have a couple of rules when I host the Lopate Show. No math and no science. We're obviously going to get into that today, so help us out as much as possible. Let's start with some of the basics about the components that actually make up cells before we get to your discovery. Let me start with you, Michael.
Sure. In terms of the motility that we're talking about here, the issue in particularly long processes like axons is how do you supply material to the end of that axon? It's sort of like maintaining our wire old phone system. You had to maintain those wires and connections. And the way that that was done was by using a filament that motor proteins moved upon. And what we've done was to, some time ago, describe or finally find which motor protein was responsible for carrying material from the cell out to the periphery as much as a meter away from the cell body.
And this is all work, this is within a cell that we're talking about.
We're talking about within a cell. Yes.
And specifically these proteins, the cytoskeleton. Ron, what is a cytoskeleton?
Well, if I can just pick up on what Mike said a little bit, just to put this in context. The cells that Mike was talking about in the nervous system, just to give you an idea of scale, a single cell in your nervous system can be a meter in length. Even though the width of that nerve cell is very small, microscopic, its length is extraordinarily long.
We don't normally think of it that way.
So if you can imagine on a macroscopic scale, we're sitting here at a approximate 6-foot table, and if we imagine the part of the nerve cell that has the DNA being about 6 feet long, the other end of that same nerve cell would extend for about 60 or 70 miles all the way from the studio down to Long Island somewhere. So there needs to be a transport system because all of the building blocks for the cell are just made in one part of the cell, which is in your spinal cord. And all that material then has to be shipped all the way, for example, from the studio down to Long Island. So the cytoskeleton is basically part of the transport system of the cell. So they're analogous to the roadways that we transport cargo on, and Federal Express trucks move on these roadways. Mm-hmm. And so the cytoskeleton provides these tracks, these highways through the nerve cell and also other cells of the body. And then there are special motors that get hooked up to the truck cargo that move material along these roadways. So it's those engines that we've been interested in studying.
Do we know exactly what these engines, these motors, are actually made of?
Sure. I mean, they're proteins. And they're similar to the muscle proteins that drive your arm as well in certain structural elements of that, which Ron, you know, worked out with a crystallography study that, you know, that was one of the major surprises that came out after the initial discovery.
James, maybe you could give us some more examples of this biological motility.
Sure. Let me pick up on what Mike and Ron already said. What's important to realize and think about right from the start is if you think about life, life is movement. Almost everyone would say, okay, that's moving, that's a living thing. And movement requires some kind of molecular machines to make that happen. So what was described by Mike and Ron about the nerve axon happens in every cell in your body, even though they're not as long as the axon cell. But so every cell in your body has its own kind of specific city plan, if you like. And so you can think of a particular cell as being like New York City with a lot of traffic moving along roads in a very directed way. And in the case of New York City, you have, you know, various kinds of automobiles, buses, and what have you, and they're all using gasoline to burn that gasoline to get chemical energy, and then they have to convert that to mechanical movement of the automobile. Precisely the same thing happens in the cells in your body, except the cars are replaced by these tiny molecular motors that we've studied for many, many years now. And many of those studies we've done together, which has been great fun for us. And we're all very good friends as well as scientific colleagues.
And this hadn't really been discovered or seen before in the
way
you guys.
Well, so the original motor, as Mike said, the original motor was myosin that was discovered actually in 1864 in Heidelberg by a scientist named Willy Kuhne, who ground up muscle and found a protein that he named myosin. So these little molecular motors, now we know there are 40 or more myosins in almost every cell in your body, and there are even more kinesins. So think of a cell as having almost 100 little tiny molecular motors that are moving along these tracks. The kinesins move along microtubules. The myosins, which are the other major class, moves along filaments called actin filaments. And they do the same thing the automobiles in New York City do. They burn a fuel. Instead of gasoline, the fuel in your body is called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. And in fact, you effectively burn almost your body weight of ATP every day. But the difference is that with the car, gasoline products are just dispelled. But in your body, the products from the ATP cleavage, where the energy comes from, the ATP is remade constantly. So it's really a very efficient machine.
I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lope. Today with me, Michael Sheets, professor of biology at Columbia, James A. Spudich, professor of biochemistry at Stanford, and Ronald Vail, a professor of cellular and molecular pharmacology from San Francisco, getting a big award tomorrow, the Lasker Award, for their work in science. I've been thinking about this a lot lately because just about a month ago I had a ligament replaced in my left knee, and I've my doctor's been helping me talk about that mobility and really on a cellular level kind of what has to happen over an eight-month period. Whether you want to comment on that or how it really affects the heart, give us a specific example of how this affects the body.
Well, the issue that I think you're referring to is the process of regeneration. And what's really different between our body and the cityscape that we're talking about is the ability of the body to regenerate, and that there is a dynamic feedback between these motors and the cells and in their environment, so that this is a repairable system and the motors are part of that repair. They're also part of shaping the organism, so that indeed one has to think, and we've moved on now in our research to really focus on that stage of how does that force get transmitted into a signal that then leads to the repair that you're talking about.
And how does it, say, affect a heartbeat?
So
that's Jim's area.
This is a good question for me because my whole lab is working on the contraction of the heart and how it works at the moment. And this is the same myosin kind of motor that Kuhne discovered in 1864, but he used skeletal muscle. And, of course, your heart muscle is doing the same sort of thing, but it's contracting rhythmically 60 times every minute approximately. That's almost 100,000 times every day. it's really important that that works really perfectly, because living 70 years at 100,000 times a day, that's a lot of heartbeats.
You want that to work,
and,
right.
And it has to work very precisely in terms of force production in order to provide the stroke volume to pump blood throughout your body. And coincidentally, this morning, a new company was announced called MyoKardia that I'm a co-founder of. And it's just been launched today. It was in the news this morning at 7 a.m. And the role of that company will be to find small molecule therapies for specific forms of heart disease, that and those are called hypertrophic and dilated cardiomyopathies. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the disease that people are familiar with when they hear about an athlete suddenly keeling over on the basketball court from sudden death.
Right.
This is due to hypertrophy of the heart that arises from a genetic mutation which you inherit, you know, from your parents. And so this is not an uncommon disease. 1 in 500 people have such a mutation. And this company and my lab in two different ways are approaching this important problem.
So I'm guessing there's a lot of practical applications of the research that you're being awarded for. In addition to this, this is about, when you say therapies, you're talking about drugs primarily, aren't you?
Absolutely. We're talking about small molecule therapies in the case of this MyoKardia new company. And then Ron can talk a bit about a company we co-founded together about 15, 16 years ago, which is doing something similar.
Tell us about that. What are the where else do these practical applications go?
Well, this was a company called Cytokinetics. Jim and I are co-founders of that company. That company now has progressed to what's called phase two clinical trials for quite an amazing drug that actually makes the performance of the motor in your heart work better than normal and produce more contraction for the heart. So this is advantageous for patients that have heart failure, where the contraction of the heart is weak. It's not pumping out the blood as efficiently as it can. And, you know, it's amazing that a drug can actually make a natural component of your body work better than it normally does. But they systematically search for such a drug. And this drug, you know, has been through trials in animals, but now in man, and you know, it makes the heart actually contract more efficiently. And now it's being tested with you know, patients suffering from heart failure, clinical trials in hospitals, and maybe later for chronic heart failure.
And the same, I should add that the same company, Cytokinetics, has additional materials in clinical trials having to do with ALS and skeletal muscle diseases.
And Michael, you know, this award-winning work that you have done, people are always looking for advancements in cancer. Is there a connection there as well?
Well, indeed, in terms of what I was talking about earlier, the feedback between the contractile systems and the growth of the cells is clearly what is awry in cancer. I mean, cancer is a mechanical disease in the sense that the cells grow in the wrong environment. And so this mechanical feedback is the issue that my lab is now focusing on, and how something like a sarcomeric unit can determine what the mechanical properties of the environment are, so as that the cells will know when to grow, when not to grow in that situation.
It sounds extremely promising. I also want to find out if there was some big aha moment in which this discovery was found. We'll find out that in just a moment. I'm speaking with Michael Sheets, professor of biology at Columbia, James A. Spoodich, professor of biochemistry at Stanford, and Ronald D. Vail, a professor of cellular and molecular pharmacology and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the University of California, San Francisco, about their discoveries concerning cytoskeletal motor proteins, which are machines that move cargoes within cells, contract muscles, and enable cell movements. They're receiving the prestigious Lasker Award for their work tomorrow, and we'll be back right after this break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate with Professors Michael Sheets, James Buttigieg, and Ronald Vail. They will be getting the Alaskar Award tomorrow night, being honored for their work on the mechanics of the motor proteins that transport material inside cells. What sparked your interest in this kind of work?
I mean, the initial, adventure was to go out on sabbatical with Jim. And I didn't tell Jim at the time what I was really interested in doing. And he tried to discourage me initially because a lot of people had tried it before and it hadn't worked. And I was incredibly lucky in the first month we got this assay system to work using these large algal cells that are about, 3 or 4 inches in length and a millimeter or two in diameter. And a neurobiologist at Stanford showed us how to cut a single cell open, flatten it out with sharpened tungsten pins, and then we put myosin on the actin cables that were there, and like on the highway, they started to move.
I'm really having trouble figuring this out. This is on a molecular level. I mean, I'm thinking Fantastic Voyage that you have to shrink a spaceship to get in there. How do you really manipulate such small things?
Well, also, just to add a size scale here, these protein motors we're talking about are a millionth of an inch in size. So they are, incredibly small compared to any man-made machine. They're actually much more efficient than any man-made machine as well. They're about 60 to 70% efficient in converting chemical energy into motion compared to a car, which is 10 to 15%. So the things that Mike is describing and will continue to describe is on a very, very small scale that one has to use special microscopes.
Well, indeed, I'm imagining you have to create new machineries and new technologies to even deal with this. Is that part of it?
Well, that was the real, from working in Jim's lab, Ron had the idea that we should really look at squid axoplasm.
Squid? And,
yeah.
Why squid?
Well, because they have axons that are about as big as that cell that I was talking about.
Now, what's an axon again?
Axon is how you communicate from the neuron to the site of innervation. So that's how your arms move and so forth.
It's
by communicating that electrical signal down the axon, and then that excites movement. So, indeed, the nervous system is built around axons and synapses.
And so you decided to work on squid.
Yeah, and that year was an El Nino year, so we couldn't go to the Stanford Marine Station, and Ron suggested we might want to go to the Woods Hole, and that was very fortuitous because groups in Woods Hole were developing microscopes, as you suggested, that would enable us to see at a level that wasn't possible before. With video enhancement, you could now observe objects that wouldn't be seen by the naked eye. And that really enabled that next set of discoveries to be made.
Did you have an idea of exactly what you were looking for and going after that, or was this a sense of discovery and things sort of fell into place as you went along?
The important thing here is that, which Mike is already describing, was the importance of taking what is a very complex process in the cell, where there are thousands of such different kind of proteins doing a lot of different things, to get it out of the cell and to observe under a microscope, in this case, what happens with just a few proteins of interest. So in this case, what Mike was describing was reconstituting movement, what we call in vitro, meaning under a microscope in the laboratory, outside of the cell with nothing more in that case than actin and myosin and ATP, the fuel. And then you can watch these things move. And that gives you the ability, you see, to take the system apart and understand how it really works. And that understanding is really critical if you want to eventually translate it to things like the cardiac drugs that we've already mentioned.
Also, if I could pick up on that and just really give you an idea of how science often works and that it really is an amazing adventure. And you know, it's not always that you have an idea and you go out to prove it. In fact, the best discoveries come when you find out you're wrong and you find something completely new and surprising. So that was pretty much the story of our working on this transport system in nerve cells. We thought initially, actually based upon the first experiments that Jim and Mike did, that it was going to be very similar to the motility system in your muscle. So we actually went out to kind of prove that hypothesis was right. And we designed experiments that were based upon that hypothesis. It turned out...
With the squid.
It turned out that hypothesis was wrong. It wasn't the same motility system used in your muscle. And instead, it led us on this path to... discover something completely new, a completely new type of molecular motor, a new type of transportation system. So,
I'll jump in here a little bit because we had collaborators in Woods Hole, and they went through a Herculean effort to really show that these transports supports, the part of the cytoskeleton that the motors were moving on, were microtubules. And one of these colleagues is going to be at the Lasker Award ceremony tomorrow, Bruce Schnapp. And I wrote him the other day about, you know, how it took him 40-some times to do this experiment and, you know, days for each one of those experiments. And he wrote back, no, it was 62. and he had his lab notebook there and so forth. So, you know, indeed, it was a Herculean effort to show that this was just a microtubule. Sorry.
And the award that you're getting, the word perseverance is part of it. How long in total were you working on this?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, because my interest in this started as a postdoctoral fellow in 1969 when I was in Cambridge, England, working with one of the true leaders in muscle biology, Hugh Huxley. And Hugh still works very hard on understanding how muscle contracts, and we really owe him a great deal because all of our work is based on essentially what he did. So it was really as a postdoc and trained before that as a biochemist, which means you want to reconstitute things outside of the cell, as I described before, that grabbed my personal interest. And so for many, many years, we were trying to create this reconstitution, and it finally really came together because Mike came to the lab and insisted on trying once again to do what we've been trying for
years.
And
I felt guilty because I hadn't worked in that field before. So.
But it was the catalyst, I guess, that made it.
Really,
so, I mean, this is the romantic movie version in my head. Was there an aha moment? Was there a moment, a day, a single moment where we went, this is it, we found it?
I think we've collectively had 6 or 7 or even 10 of those. And one was certainly the one Mike described earlier of seeing the first movement in vitro, that means out of the cell under a microscope in the lab. That was certainly one aha moment.
And do you end up trying to recreate this? Are there animations or other ways that you try to prove or to set what you've done?
We haven't made the Hollywood version yet, but anyway.
but everyone's satisfied that it's happening. It's an amazing discovery. Let me just switch to some general questions for you, if I could. We often hear that students in this country are falling behind in science and math, and that fewer people are pursuing careers in science. That must depress you when you hear about that. Are you hopeful at all that we can turn that around as a culture?
Well, Ron's been involved in education. He was just at high schools yesterday.
Yeah, I spent the day yesterday in the Bronx and went to Bronx Science, Bronx Leadership Academy, and Young Women's Leadership School as well, and just talked to them about the science, the fun of doing science, how, you know, one can actually use scientific thinking not just to be a scientist, but in many other kinds of careers and ways of approaching one's life. And and try to also get through to them, not just with science, but actually, you know, stories of how people became scientists, why science is interesting and fun. You know, I think it is a challenge right now, an important challenge for the whole country to really interest young people in science, in part because later in their lives there are going to be important decisions that society is going to have to make that's going to be based on kind of rational thinking about scientific evidence. And I think collectively as scientists we have to do better jobs of reaching out to the community and making it a partnership and involving them in the science that we're doing. So I think it's, you know, an important mission, especially for people that are as lucky as us to get such a special recognition as the Lasker Award to invest some of our time to these kinds of activities.
Absolutely. Mm. I would second that. And look, I was born in a small town in the middle of Illinois, and my entire career is public education. I very much appreciate how good it was during those years. It's incredibly important, and everybody has to understand that this is fundamentally the main thing we need to fix in this country, and it's a matter of our leadership understanding the importance of it really fully and putting the right energy into making it be what it should be.
And, you know, I'll, you know, totally second what has been said and add further that a lot of the aspects of science really involve delayed gratification. In other words, that you have to work for a long time before you ever see any output of that. And the culture as it is right now with instant this and instant that, you know, runs counter to that. Whether that, you know, can be counteracted in some way or not, or another remains to be seen, but indeed there is reason for delayed gratification and holding off to, you know, we've waited for 30 years now for these awards. And indeed, if our lives in the meantime had been, you know, waiting for this, it wouldn't have been very full. But, you know, the point is to do what you think is important, the fundamentals, and then things will turn out well.
We have a listener left a question on our show page, currently studying anatomy and physiology at Beth Israel School of Nursing. How would you describe the structure and function of muscle cells in layman's terms, is the question. Are there any relatively easy books you would recommend to help students better understand and visualize the work that you've been doing? Everyone's pointing to Professor Spudich.
Hey, Jim.
Well, we talked about these tracks, either in the case of muscle, actin filaments that act as little roads along which these myosin motors move. The way to visualize the muscle is that you have an incredibly highly organized, dense array of such tracks, and thousands and thousands of these myosin molecules that are tied together into bundles. And it's a collective action of a lot of these myosins working on many of the actin filaments, pulling little structures in your muscle together that causes the whole muscle to then shorten, and then you lift your arm.
Big picture, is there anything about your work that has some kind of understanding about the nature of evolution?
Well, you know, so we described a problem that we worked on in nerve cells, how the transportation system worked. We discovered a molecular motor that was involved in that. Jim's been working, you know, for his whole life on these muscle contractile systems and that motor. And we thought for more than a decade that these two transportation systems were completely unrelated to one another. And there was many evidence suggesting that. But then we got a detailed atomic information on exactly what these proteins look like. And they look amazingly similar to one another. Even though they work on different roadways, they work in different tissues, they have different functions, it's pretty clear that these two motors came very long time ago from some common ancestor, some ancient, very early kind of molecular machine that then one went off and controlled muscles and another one went off and developed transportation of nerve cells. So it was an amazing finding, and it actually brought our whole fields together. People in our fields actually didn't talk to one another that much. They had separate meetings. And then we found out that we're actually studying variations of the same machine.
That's so interesting. And let me ask you, getting this award tomorrow night, Pierre Hotel, the Lasker Award, how does that affect your research? Does that just mean more recognition and makes you feel better, or does it really move the research even further along?
Makes us work harder.
Right.
It's like getting an Oscar, I guess, right?
That's right.
Any other changes in your life based on that?
Hopefully not. I mean, we're enjoying doing what we do, and, you know, I couldn't imagine doing anything else, you know, if I had all the money and time in the world. So, you know, that's...
Just looking back, looking forward to getting back to Stanford and get back to the lab.
Right.
Let me ask you, one of our listeners asked you to repeat the companies that you founded, too, so we can they can do some more research on that. Just mention those briefly.
Well, the first one was Cytokinetics back in 1998 or so. And the one that was launched today is called Myocardia, M-Y-O-K-A-R-D-I-A.
Michael P. Sheets, professor of biology at Columbia, James A. Spudich, professor of biochemistry at Stanford, and Ronald D. Vale, a professor of cellular and molecular pharmacology and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the University of California, San Francisco, getting the Lasker Award tomorrow night. Congratulations, gentlemen, and thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.